Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Jonathan Safran Foer. Jonathan is one of the most influential figures in modern literature. He's author of the wildly popular novels Everything is Illuminated and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. The New Yorker magazine selected him as one of 20 writers then under the age of 40 that the magazine believes are or will be key to their generation. Then a few years ago, when he became a father, Jonathan felt compelled to investigate the food industry so that he could make informed choices about what he would feed his new son, Sasha. This led him on a path that brought him to the 2009 publication of his landmark book, Eating Animals. Jonathan's discoveries and his eloquent sharing of his own learning journey have inspired hundreds of thousands of people to rethink their food choices in light of the realities of modern meat production. So now, Jonathan, my dad and I are so grateful for your work and so happy that we get to have this time with you. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Thank you, Ocean. And Jonathan, it is a true pleasure to have your voice as part of our summit and your wisdom reaching our audience. And I want to start with something Ocean just mentioned, which is you've said that you had long felt uncertain about how you felt about eating meat. You were an on-again, off-again vegetarian, but that the birth of your first child inspired an urgency because you would have to make decisions on his behalf. And that was the urgency that inspired your book, Eating Animals. A lot of parents today just acquiesce and let food companies like McDonald's and Coca-Cola decide what their kids will eat and drink. It's convenient, it's tasty, it's inexpensive. How old are your children now, and how is it going for you as a father who has sought to take conscious responsibility for the food you feed your kids?
My kids are 5 and 8, newly 5 and newly 8 as of just a couple weeks ago, and it's going very well. In many ways, these are the easy years, you know, because I think it's vastly easier to explain to a child why you don't eat meat than why you do, given the rest of the kinds of stories and the models of behavior that we present to our children. You know, we read bedtime stories with animals as heroes. Many people have pets, and kids are taught to engage with them in certain ways, that some kind of behavior, namely kind behavior, is good and that unkind behavior is bad. And then we have this other thing that we do with animals, which is killing them and eating their bodies. So to explain to a child why one wouldn't eat meat, it makes perfect sense. It almost doesn't require any explanation. Now, I anticipate that as they grow older and as they, first of all, acquire a certain kind of rebelliousness, but also as they are sort of more strongly subjected to the cultural norms, which right now are meat eating, it might change a little bit, but so far so good. In fact, really quite easy. The one thing that I would add to what you said is you said many parents acquiesce or don't really give it a lot of thought. I think that it's worth remembering, or at least stating, you know, where the blame lies. It's hard to blame most parents or to be critical of the choice to feed children meat when we have been bombarded with sort of institutionalized, systematized lies about what is healthy and what is unhealthy, what a growing body needs. You know, I know many parents who are at least as thoughtful and at least as responsible and at least as sensitive as I am who feed their children meat because they are part of this culture, this American culture, which has not only promoted a diet that includes and is in fact centered on meat, but considers it a necessity. The reason I mention that now at the beginning of this conversation is a lot of people, I think, are ready to approach different ways of eating and different ways of thinking about food, And the conversation has to be a forgiving one, a humble one, and one that points blame where it actually exists, which I believe is the industry.
The industry seems intent on keeping parents and people in general, it seems to me, unaware of how animals are treated in factory farms. They want to keep the veil in place, and they even pass or try to pass ag gag laws that make it illegal for people to expose animal abuse that takes place in factory farms.
Well, not just animal abuse, but environmental abuse, abuse of our bodies, abuse of farmers, how farmers are treated. The interesting thing about factory farming is there's no way of looking at it. There's no perspective that makes it appealing. The only thing that makes its continuation possible is ignorance and silence. You know, I did interviews across the country when Eating Animals came out for about 2 years. And whenever I was on television, the host would always try to have a competing voice, someone sitting opposite me who could present arguments on behalf of factory farming. And they could never find anybody. It's not because the industry isn't interested in defending itself. It's because the industry is smart enough to realize that as this conversation expands, people are going to be led toward other ways of eating, other kinds of eating, and that their best argument is actually silence. You know, I found it really incredibly difficult to do the research for the book. It often required doing things that are quite scary. I never had to break the law, but most people who want to see the inside of a farm do have to break the law. And it's just crazy that that's something that we accept. Any other thing that you give your money to and want to know about, you can find a wealth of information with some ease. But if you want to know about the animal products that are in your refrigerator, you are just completely out of luck.
I don't think you have to be a vegetarian or an animal rights activist to be appalled if you see what's actually done to animals in factory farms. I think, though, that there are people, many people actually, who don't really want to see. They don't want to feel the pain they would experience if they were to lift the veil. And, of course, the animal agriculture industry wants to keep the veil in place. You've sought to expose what are, in many cases, painful truths that the industry would like to keep hidden and that some of us would rather not look at. What troubles you the most?
Well, you know, nobody wants to look at this stuff. I don't want to look at it. You don't want to look at it. Nobody wants to look at it because it is so extremely unpleasant. It is, if nothing else, incredibly sad. It says something very tragic about the world that we live in and perhaps even about us, us meaning humanity. And I would only add it to the list of things that I don't want to know about because they are so sad. They say something tragic about our world and about us. I don't like being confronted with the problem of homelessness. I don't like being confronted with the problem of hungry children. I don't like being confronted with the problem of the devastation of the Amazon rainforest. It is painful to have to confront either one's own hypocrisy or the responsibility to change one's life in ways that for many people is quite dramatic and even can feel impossible. So the question is, what do we do with these tragic truths in the world? Do we choose to close our eyes and ears to them, or do we choose to engage with them? I think one challenge for people who care about these issues is finding ways to engage people. I have always been convinced, and I've never been more convinced, that the average person cares about animals. The average person cares about the environment. These are not radical positions. They're not Democrat or Republican positions. They are not old or young or urban or rural positions. I think they're fundamentally human concerns. They are what it means to be a decent human. So the challenge is, how do we have this conversation in a way that reminds people that these are things we all care about, instead of in ways that are divisive and make people feel aggressive or defensive? And I think a lot of it is, as I said earlier in this conversation, finding a kind of modesty in the tone. You know, the modesty of, you're not perfect, I'm not perfect. You're a hypocrite. I'm a hypocrite. We're not going to let our fear of hypocrisy stop us from taking the first steps toward the people that we want to be.
What was the truth you discovered in the course of your research that you found most upsetting or alarming?
I think it was the breadth of the industry's reach. You know, I knew that factory farming was quite prevalent. I didn't realize that more than 99.9% of the animals that are sold in supermarkets and restaurants are raised on factory farms. I didn't realize that alternatives are not only the exception, but for all intents and purposes, non-existent. And coming to terms with both the destruction and violence wreaked by this industry and its utter domination of the American marketplace and its imminent domination of the world marketplace was truly eye-opening.
In the book, you include a lengthy statement from Frank Rees, a turkey farmer, who says that today's turkeys have been so genetically altered that not a single turkey that you can buy today in a supermarket was able to walk normally. And he adds that every turkey sold in every store and served in every restaurant, even if it's marketed as organic, is the product of artificial insemination. This isn't done just for efficiency. It's done because these animals have been so manipulated by breeding programs that they are physically incapable of having sex. Why did you include this turkey farmer's statement in your book?
First of all, I felt that it's one thing to hear an argument about meat production from a vegetarian. It's an altogether different thing to hear it from someone who makes his livelihood in meat production. So Frank Rees, who's quite an incredible guy, eats meat, of course. He raises animals for meat. He takes animals to be slaughtered. He is not somebody who believes that raising animals for meat is in any way wrong. But, and this is a very big pivot, he believes that just because raising animals for meat isn't wrong doesn't mean that everything is right. It doesn't mean that nothing is wrong. And this is one of the things I wanted to sort of orient my book around. I think a lot of people, when they're confronting the question of vegetarianism, boil it down to, in the abstract, is it right or wrong to eat meat? Despite having thought about these questions, the related questions, for really my whole life, and having thought about them quite intensely for about 3 years, I'm not sure I have an answer to that question. I don't exactly know how I feel if it is fundamentally wrong always to eat an animal. What I came to learn is it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you think of that question when you are living in a world in which 99.9% of the animals that we eat come from factory farms. Now, one can think that in the abstract, on the perfect farm where an animal is allowed to engage in all of its species-specific behavior and spend its lifetime with its, you know, family members and eat the kinds of food that are good for it, that it wants to eat, and be out in pastures and be in the sunlight and be slaughtered in such a way that it has no anticipation of or experience of its death. Is that wrong? Maybe, maybe not. What we can say for sure is it's wrong to keep a pregnant animal in a cage so small that it can't turn around for the duration of its pregnancy. It's wrong to breed animals that are incapable of walking. It's wrong to breed animals that are incapable of reproducing sexually. It is wrong to give 7 times the amount of antibiotics to healthy animals as we do to sick human beings. It is wrong to keep animals indoors for their entire lives, and so on and so on. What we need to do is orient this conversation around the world in which we live, not a hypothetical world. You know, it's amazing. I'm sure you've experienced this too. When you have a conversation about vegetarianism or animal welfare with somebody, it often goes very, very quickly to the extremes. The hypothetical extremes, like, well, come on, if your house was being overrun by bugs, can you honestly tell me you wouldn't get an exterminator? Or, yes, yes, but come on, that tiny tag at the back of your pair of sneakers appears to be made of leather. Or, come on, if you were on a deserted island and there's only you and a cow, would you really die of starvation before you ate the cow? I have no idea what my answer to those questions is. What I know is none of those situations are as pressing as the 50 billion animals that are being factory farmed in the world right now, or the 100 billion that are going to have to be factory farmed if the Chinese and Indians take on an American diet. Nothing is as pressing as a system of animal agriculture that, according to the United Nations, produces more greenhouse gases than everything else in the world put together. And that's one of the top two or three causes of every significant environmental problem on the planet, locally and globally. Air pollution, water pollution, loss of biodiversity, deforestation. These are things that are happening right now, and they're happening in front of us, and they're happening on a global and truly massive scale. So if we can make the conversation less about hypotheticals and less about identities, you know, I'm a vegetarian, I'm a hypocrite, I'm a vegan, I'm a carnivore, but instead oriented around our shared concerns. I'm somebody who cares about animal welfare, like, by the way, 96% of Americans do. I am somebody who cares about air pollution and water pollution. It's hard to imagine the person who doesn't. So here are the ways that I act on my concerns. I act on my care. They might not be exactly the same ways that you do. Some people do more, some people do less. Some people are able to do more than other people. But nobody is prevented from doing something. And so what we need to do is make people feel good about taking the first step instead of feeling bad about being unable to take the final step.
You mentioned that in time your children will grow up and be more exposed to the cultural norms. Have you ever been afraid that they would feel isolated from their peers on account of eating differently?
I've never been afraid they've been isolated, no. Part of that might simply be where we live, which is in Brooklyn, where there are people eating in different ways everywhere you look. I'm also not overly concerned because 18% of college students in America now describe themselves as vegetarians. There are more vegetarians than Catholics on American campuses. So we're not talking about a fringe identity. And more than that, we're not talking about something that people sort of modestly or shyly fess up to. It used to be the case 10 years ago that they were more vegetarians than would admit to it. Now more people admit to it than are actually vegetarians. It's become an aspirational identity.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a young person now in college, the question nobody would ask, why don't you eat meat? It's just not puzzling. The question might be, why do you eat meat? And I think by the time that my kids are in college, that 18% will have grown, undoubtedly. The sort of cultural perception of thoughtful eating, I think, will also have changed.
Well, in time, your children will make their own decisions as to what they will eat and how they'll live. What are the messages that you wish to give them now as they're growing up, both by what you say and what you do, about themselves and about their food choices?
Well, in a way, there's two questions there. One is, what are the lessons as applied to questions about food choices? And the other is, how do we want to think of ourselves? So with regards to food choices, you know, I have strong opinions, and I hope that they'll share my opinions, but I wouldn't insist on it. And the way I think about parenting and trying to be a thoughtful parent is not to create an ethical replica of me. It's not to create somebody who acts on my beliefs. It's to help somebody to become an adult who can act on his own beliefs. And I say that with the knowledge that our beliefs will diverge. You know, I don't think there's ever been a parent-child relationship where beliefs didn't diverge to some extent on some issue. I want my kids to be aware of the choices that are in front of them, be aware of their ability to make different choices, to be confident when making choices that are outside of societal norms, and to forgive themselves. I think a huge part of being a thoughtful person is forgiving yourself for not being perfect. I know so many, I mean, I'm sure you've heard a million stories like this too of lapsed vegetarians. You know, I was a vegetarian for 6 years. And I'll say, well, why'd you stop? And they'll say, well, I was in an airport one night and I was really hungry. My hands were shaking and the only thing that was open was a McDonald's and the only thing they had was McNuggets. So I ate them. And I'll say, and then what? And I'll say, well, that was the end of my vegetarianism. It's a very strange thing to say. It's really strange, but I've heard so many different versions of that. And I think it's based in this idea that there's like a line that once you cross it, you can't come back. That we're talking about a religion or we're talking about a law rather than an effort, a process that lasts one's lifetime. And I hope that my kids think about their food choices, but also their other choices as increments in this process that lasts a lifetime.
I hear you saying that for you, it's not about signing a purity pact or achieving some level of purity. It's about aligning your choices and supporting your children in aligning theirs as they grow up with their higher selves, with their compassion, with their vision for how they want to live. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, we don't need to all reach the same conclusions, but, you know, if we were all, as I was saying earlier, I do think that there are beliefs that we all share. There's certain kinds of decencies that matter to all of us. You just don't find the person in mainstream society, the sort of non-deranged person who is completely indifferent to animal suffering. That person doesn't exist. Which is to say, everybody cares. You know, we can care in different ways. We can care in different amounts. Some people include fish in their circle of concern. Some people don't. Some people think it is always wrong in any situation to use an animal toward any human end. Other people think it's only wrong to raise them indoors in cramped quarters. We can get into the splitting hairs, and that can be really productive and interesting, but if we took as the beginning that we all care, like let's help each other care, and let's respect the differences between the degrees to which we care and our abilities to care and our methods of caring, if we could just do that, I think nothing makes the meat industry happier than seeing people carrying posters that say meat is murder. You know, PETA has been enormously successful, one of the most successful advocacy groups in American history. And they've done so by winning over about 2 out of every 10 people that they approach. But if we're serious about these problems, we can't lose the other 8 out of 10. I think that the meat is murder sign really risks losing a lot of people because it is in effect saying, if you eat meat, you're a murderer, as opposed to saying, you're somebody like me who cares about animals. You're somebody like me who cares about the environment. Here's what the meat industry is doing. What are some different approaches we could have that would limit that harm? You know, if you were to say to me, in 10 years, will the majority of Americans be vegetarian? I would say there's approaching zero chance of that. But if you were to say in 10 years, is it possible that the majority of meals eaten in America will be vegetarian? I would say I think there's a good chance of that. In terms of the impact on animals and on the environment, they're equal. If half of the population is vegetarian or if half of the meals are vegetarian. So we should be moving toward the goals that are perhaps most within reach, especially because once we start moving in these directions, it becomes contagious. Compassion is like a muscle. The more you use it, the stronger it gets. And it feels good. People often have the perspective that being a vegetarian is some kind of deprivation. It's depressing. It's sad. And then they experiment with it, and they find it actually feels great. In fact, the pleasure, I don't mean the sort of moral satisfaction that you feel, but simply what it does to your mood to act on your beliefs, to say no to something that you otherwise would want, I think feels better than any meal could. You know, I've met so many people who have discovered that.
I read an interview that you gave shortly after your book came out in which you expressed that thought in a particularly eloquent way, I thought, and I want to read it to our listeners. You said, if we don't say no to this, what do we say no to? If we don't say no to something that systematically abuses 50 billion animals, if we don't say no to the number one cause of global warming, if we don't say no to what the UN has said is one of the top 2 or 3 causes of every significant environmental problem in the world, if we don't say no to something that the World Health Organization says is a prime factor in the generation of avian and swine flus, if we don't say no to something that's making our antibiotics ineffective, just what do we say no to? Jonathan, what keeps us from saying no?
As you said earlier, eating meat is convenient, and it tastes good to most people, and it is cheap for most people. at least in terms of the price you pay at the cash register. And it's what we do, and it's what we've done. It's what our parents did, and our grandparents did, and our great-grandparents. And we should just acknowledge that that makes it difficult. This is not going to be an easy thing for most people. I wrote a book on the subject. You know, it's important to me. It still took me a long time to come around. It did. And I think we should expect it. It will take a fairly long time for people to come around. I think the amount of time it will take and the effort involved is going to become less and less and less, especially for younger people. The older we are, the more ingrained our habits are, the harder they are to change. But for high school students and college students, it's not only quite easy, it's inspiring. It's what they do. But, you know, I'm extremely understanding of and forgiving of people who know that this is the right thing to do for them. They know that this is what they want to do and are having a hard time doing it. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had like this. Like, the editor of the book, actually, in England, said to me, you know, you won me over. The book persuaded me. But can I say something embarrassing? I said, sure. He said, I love sushi. I know how dumb that sounds. I know how weak you must think I am, how foolish you must think I am, but I really love it. And I said to him, well, how often do you eat it? He said, I don't know, twice a week. And I said, well, eat it. Why would you let those two meals a week prevent you in the other 19 meals a week that you eat from doing what you know is right and what you want to do? And I think it's because we have this mindset that as soon as we are imperfect, we should stop trying. And that's because we think about this question in terms of identity. You're a vegetarian or you're not a vegetarian. Well, I would much rather have somebody who 19 out of the 21 meals a week is a vegetarian because he's comfortable with that, what you might call hypocrisy or inconsistency or just imperfection. The world is much better if we have people doing that than people turning away from the choice and saying, because I can't be a vegetarian, I'm going to be nothing.
Some people, in trying to take a step in the right direction, eat organic foods when they can, and I think that's a good thing. I think they are, in general, almost always safer, less contaminated, healthier, and certainly carry a smaller ecological footprint. For meat and dairy products and eggs to be labeled organic, the USDA requires that animals have access to the outdoors. That's the phrase. But you write that in some cases, access to the outdoors can mean nothing more than having the opportunity to look outside through a screened window. Are there then any assurances that consumers have or can have that organic meats are from animals who've been spared the worst or the tortured conditions that are so prevalent in mass production factory farming?
No. But that having been said, you know, on the whole, generally speaking, it's certainly better. You know, it comes down to a very personal kind of math. What are you comfortable with? If you knew that there was a 1 in 1,000 chance that the animal you were eating experienced its own torture over the course of many minutes, would you be comfortable eating it? If you knew that there was a 1 in 10 chance, if you knew that there was a 1 in 5 chance, if you knew that there was a 1 in 3 chance, these aren't questions for which there are objective answers. It's personal math. So eating organic increases your personal math. If the question is, does it get one off the hook? The answer is no. You know, there are all kinds of problems with organic meat production. If you're looking for something, a kind of silver bullet, where you no longer have to worry about how the animal is raised or what the environmental effects are, then that's not it.
What does it say about us that cage-free eggs are today one of the fastest growing sectors of the food industry?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You couldn't find cage-free eggs probably, 10 years ago? Pretty much anywhere. Maybe in the kind of specialty food shop. And now they sell them in gas stations. It's a food that doesn't taste any better. Not in any way. And it's a food that is no better for you in any way. And people are buying them despite the fact that they cost more simply because it's the right thing to do. They're buying them in Berkeley, California, and they're buying them in Mobile, Alabama. They're buying them everywhere. And I think it comes back to these shared values. There are things that really across the board we just are uncomfortable with. As soon as there are alternatives in front of us, those shared values become apparent really quickly.
We're seeing currently a shift, I think, in the cultural conventional thinking around gay marriage, where that is becoming a lot more acceptable and appreciated as a human right. And it seems as though we may be seeing a similar shift in the culture around taking crimes against animals seriously, so that the idea of an egg coming from a hen who wasn't in a cage has value. There's a sense that that's a significant moral difference, that there's a repugnance or disgust to factory farming in its worst expressions. Do you see that?
Well, a lot of these seemingly disparate questions comes down to how large our circle of compassion is. You know, what does it include? In our not terribly distant past, the dominant circle of compassion didn't include people of color or didn't include women. What we've seen historically is that the circle only expands. It has never contracted. We never move toward less inclusiveness. We never move toward less sympathy. We always are pushing the circle out. It's a very exciting time to be alive because it seems to be radiating quite quickly. I know that by the time that my children are my age, it will certainly include animals.
At this point in history, at this moment on Earth, are you optimistic or pessimistic?
Well, I think that there are reasons to be optimistic and there are reasons to be pessimistic. The reasons to be pessimistic are more people are eating meat than ever before, more meat is being consumed, and more cultures are starting to imitate the American diet, which is to say a big piece of meat in the middle of the plate. There's also some concern about our ability to correct or to remedy the damage that we've already done, both in terms of the breeding of animals and the environmental destruction. The reasons to be optimistic, I think, are found in that 18% I spoke of earlier, the 18% of self-identifying vegetarians on college campuses. When those 18% become politicians and journalists and actors and musicians and artists and the louder speaking voices in our culture, it's easy to imagine how this conversation will feel dramatically different than it does right now.
There's a famous quote from Tolstoy. He said that as long as there are slaughterhouses, there will always be battlefields. Do you find that statement to be just hyperbole, or do you find there is some meaning in it?
I think it's hyperbole, but I also think there's some meaning in it.
Both and. Yeah.
It can be itself a little bit overblown while also gesturing at something that's true, which is thoughtfulness begets thoughtfulness, both because it is contagious. The feeling of caring is good. The feeling of acting on one's caring is so good that we want to do more of it. But also, as we open our eyes to one set of problems, we inevitably see other problems and want to participate in the correction of them as well. I think if we were more thoughtful eaters, we would inevitably be more thoughtful in other ways, and sure, it would extend ultimately to things like battlefields.
Jonathan, there's so much I appreciate about you and your work and your message and your way of speaking to us. I feel your respect for us all. I feel your respect for yourself. And there's a dignity in that and a grace. And I feel your respect for life. Your book, your compassion, your humility, your sense of how stories define our lives, these are gifts to us all. And I want to thank you on behalf of all of our listeners for your outstanding work and for being with us today. And I thank you truly on behalf of all of life.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be here. I didn't mention this at any point in the interview, but it was reading your work a couple decades ago Actually, I remember exactly where I was in my childhood home, sitting up in bed, flipping through the pages of Diet for New America, and feeling for the first time as if these were problems that I couldn't at once ignore while being the person that I wanted to be. So the thanks is very much mutual.
We've been talking with Jonathan Safran Foer, author of Eating Animals, teacher at Yale and New York universities, and one of the leading literary giants of our times. Jonathan, your children, and I believe all of our children, are blessed by your thoughtful, sober, and compassionate insights. It has been a true privilege to share this time with you, and we want to thank you for your work and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Thank you so much.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 23 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. If you like, you can also get CDs, members-only courses, and a lot more. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thanks so much for joining us in the Food Revolution. If you want to express your opinions on what you've been hearing or find out what other people are saying, we invite you to post and engage in the comments section at the bottom of our broadcasts page. This now concludes day 4 of the Food Revolution Summit. Come back and join us tomorrow for the Science of Healthy Eating, how the latest scientific breakthroughs can help you to thrive. We'll be hearing from Dr. Neil Barnard on Power Foods, dietitian Brenda Davis on Cutting Edge Nutrition, and Dr. T. Colin Campbell on the science of food and health. So please come back and join us tomorrow. We wish you health, we wish you happiness, and we wish you lots of good food.